suspect.
No.
So I don't know who he is. Or, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him.
Well, yeah.
I want him, hell, I want justice. Dead or alive.
Well, yeah.
It's about him sending AIDS and protects terrorists.
Well,
including members of Al-Qaeda.
Well,
I know I didn't say, but there was a direct connection between September the 11th. Saddam Hussein.
Well,
war is my last choice. We're gonna smoke them out. Bring them on.
Well,
you think Patriot Act, constitutional guarantees are in place? A wiretap requires a court order.
Well,
Saddam Hussein has got weapons of mass destruction. Although we have not found stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction,
well,
and it is true that much of the intelligence.
For returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to a debate, should we genetically modify foods? You can hear this program at 96.5 FM, or you can go to axissacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
You that we are in the question and answer section of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. I'm John Donvan, your moderator, and we have four debaters, two teams of two, debating this motion, genetically modify food. And Alison Van Inen and your opponents have said that in fact, after getting off to a good start, in a sense, the big success story of Roundup Ready wheat and BT corn have somewhat backfired, and that their impact on the environment has begun to be a negative because they've led to the weeds resistant to herbicide and to pesticides and more spraying as a result. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, again, I think you've got to look at the application and what the actual product is, and I think it's the effect of BT crops has been a dramatic reduction in insecticide use, especially in the developing world. And I mean, I stated the summary of that paper, which said the adoption has reduced chemical pesticide use by 37%. So there have been a number of studies that have looked at herbicides, and in some cases they've substituted Roundup for a different herbicide that they were using that was more environmentally degrading and that stayed longer in the environment.
Okay,
and so they've moved to a safer.
You've nailed
herbicide.
That point. I just want to take it to your opponent to respond.
I just want to point
Margaret
out
Mellon.
That, for example, the meta-study of the 147 other studies, none of those studies were done after the evolution of resistant organisms, of resistant insects.
So you're saying we don't know? You're saying that what your opponent
says? No, I'm saying that the good news stories about biotechnology crops, and there are some, are all from the early days. But we know that it is inevitable that resistance is going to develop.
Chuck Benbrook.
John asked about to open up a discussion of the environmental impacts. Roundup Ready crops are grown now.
Take 15 seconds and tell people what? The dynamic of Roundup Ready crops.
Okay, so farmer has a field of corn, soybeans, cotton, and weeds come up. Roundup is glyphosate herbicides, and in 1996, the first genetically engineered so-called herbicide-tolerant crop came on the market. And scientists at Monsanto put a new gene into corn, soybeans, cotton, and now other crops that makes it possible to spray glyphosate, which kills everything green that's growing. It would kill the corn without the gene. And so farmers can spray this broad-spectrum herbicide, a very effective herbicide.
And not kill their corn.
Not kill the corn, but kill the weeds. In the early years, it worked great. But in 2000, in Delaware, in a soybean field, the first glyphosate-resistant weed, it was a Mars tail, was created by Roundup Ready soybeans. By 2004, we had 6 or 8 different serious glyphosate-resistant weeds, mostly in the southeast, including this Palmer amaranth that the stalk of it can get as big as a person's wrist, and it was breaking the cutter bars on cotton harvesting machines. And now there's like perhaps 100 million acres.
I want to give you 15 more seconds. How did those weeds get to be resistant to Roundup? What was their interaction with the corn?
When you spray one herbicide over and over again on weeds, they're going to develop resistance.
Okay, I just wanted people to understand. It's sort of a random mutation. So I want to take that to Rob Fraley.
Sure.
This is your area.
It's real simple. You've all heard of antibiotic resistance. It's a problem, right? You're aware of it. So what should drug companies do? Should they not develop new antibiotics just because there's become a resistance to an antibiotic? Absolutely not. Roundup controls hundreds of weeds. In this country, 12 of them have become resistant. It still controls hundreds of weeds. It needs to be used effectively. And Chuck, you were one of the first ones to point out that we should actually use combinations of herbicides, and that's what growers are doing today, and that's one of the benefits of being smarter and stewarding these products better.
Rob, back when we had that conversation, I might have Chuck also suggested it's not a great idea to put antibiotics in plants.
We're going to go to audience questions now, and so raise your hand. The mic will be brought to you. I can't resist calling on Bill Nye, the science guy.
Woo-hoo! Hi, Bill.
But I have to say, Bill Nye, the science guy, that your question also has to be as good as everybody else's. So,
my question is about time. Everybody can agree, I think, that you can know exactly what happens to any organism, any plant, any crop. But you cannot know, I believe, you cannot know what happens to an ecosystem. So can the four of you agree on a number of seasons, a number of years, a number of plantings and harvestings where we would be, I think what people are concerned about is the effects on an ecosystem where you accidentally create
you were almost at a question mark there.
Say again?
You were almost at a question mark. You were 4 words away.
Well, what is the time scale for each side? Is it for in geologic time, it's at least centuries, not 5 seasons. So that's what everybody, I think, what many people are concerned about with regard to genetically modified
Thank
food.
You. Let's take it to Margaret Mellon.
Well, I mean, from my perspective, the time scale, you know, is something like decades. I mean, in the decades that we have seen herbicide-tolerant crops, the monarch population has decreased by almost 80%, and it is certainly because they've been deprived of their food, which is a milkweed. We're seeing effects on honeybees, and they're all subtle effects. You know, it's not like killing the honeybees. It's making it impossible for the honeybee to find its way back to the nest.
And that's why decades, you're saying.
Crayfish and earthworms. I mean, we are seeing effects right now that have ecological implications. So the time scale is not that great.
Alison Van Inenum.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're conflating the technology with other issues. The monarch butterfly is due to more effective controls of milkweed. And so if we want more weed, then we should grow more weed. But the fact that we're controlling weeds more effectively...
No.
I guess from California, I probably shouldn't say that.
That's another debate. Yes or no to this statement?
And, you know, there's been no association with GMs and honeybees. I think that's just a red herring.
No, there is.
Let me bring it to Chuck.
Glyphosate.
What concerns me is that we're talking about problems that are associated with the technology without considering the benefits. And there's trade-offs with every production system. And what we need to do is remove the problems but retain the benefits, not just throw the technology
Chuck
out.
Pembroke.
What I'm concerned about, and many scientists, is that GE crops came on the market in 1996. Monsanto and Rob Fraley's very talented molecular biologists, they're on their fifth generation now of genetically engineered corn. None of the GE corns that have been on the market have had a dominant position for more than 5 or 6 years. I would like to have the ability to at least do two crop rotation cycles, which might be 6 or 8 years, to see how the farming system has responded. But in that time period, the technology has changed. So you never really get a handle on what has happened.
The conquistadors came with their sabers and guns, and they raped and they slaughtered until they were done. They hacked and they killed and left no one alive. Then they brought in the slaves they allowed to survive. Welcome to the new world, you could hear the men say, as they sat on the shores of Guantanamo Bay. After 400 years, independence was short. That's just how it is with the deepwater port. The battleships came and they never left shore. Tasting the conquest, they just wanted more. The sign said, welcome to the U.S. of A. In the Republic of Cuba, Guantanamo Bay. Past the barbed wire in the field of mines, you can see the men who left their families behind. To burn neath the sun, to be tortured and killed, where their stomachs are empty and their spirits are grilled. If you're looking for freedom, this is the price you must pay. It's written in blood on Guantanamo Bay. The vultures, they circle at ease overhead. The living may live and the dead will be dead. The time it may come in this tropical heat that they'll have to go somewhere else to eat. Maybe a storm will come wash it away. Still the guard towers glitter on Guantanamo Bay.
And now, back to the debate. Should we genetically modify foods?
Okay, I'm going to go to another question. Far up in the corner, very vociferous waving there.
It seems like we're always comparing the success rates of GMO farming to a very, very chemically driven agriculture and not to an organic agriculture. And that's where I get very confused with the argument, because the against side seems to be against the chemically driven agriculture, whether it's in GMOs
okay.
or not. And is it viable to feed a world with organic farming?
Do we need the technology to survive? Who sure. would like to take it? Marty Mellon.
First of all, the challenge of feeding the world's hungry people is not one that is met by production of any kind. I mean, if you want to feed hungry people around the world, I can give you a list of 10 things to do. You can build roads, you can raise their incomes, you can change the role of women, you can help people make their own decisions about what they want to grow and help them grow it. So production itself is not an answer to the problems of hunger. But beyond that, I want to say that, you know, that genetic engineering, as I tried to say in my introductory remarks, is not really producing the kinds of traits that we need. Now, I will just refer to one study in Nature magazine. It was a project. It started in 2010, trying to help African farmers develop corn crops that would grow on nitrogen-poor soils. Now, in that period of time, that project has been able to produce 21 conventionally bred varieties of corn adapted, you know, around Africa that grow better in their bare, nitrogen-poor soils. Genetic engineering, which was also used, has produced one, and they don't think it'll be ready for 10 years.
Okay, point made. Let's let Robert Fraley respond.
I was going to say that we might actually reach some alignment. We've talked a lot about our differences, and one of the points I wanted to make, and food security challenge is the biggest challenge we face. We have to double the available food in 36 years. It's important that we make the right decisions today. The other important point on farming, and we've talked a lot about small farmers, my mentor was a guy named Dr. Norman Borlaug, and Norman always made the point, if you help a farmer, you help poverty. 70% of the world's poor are farmers. If you give them better tools to farm even incrementally better, you address not only poverty, but you address food security. And so these are all complex, interrelated issues. There are no simple solutions, but I think we should play the game with all of our tools.
And that concludes round two of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, where our motion is genetically modify food. On to round three. Round three, closing statements by each debater in turn. And here to speak for the motion, Allison Van Eenennaam, a genomics and biotechnology researcher in the Department of Animal Science at UC Davis.
For too long, the debate over the merits of genetically modified food has focused on unrealized hypothetical risks and has been conflated with the use of pesticides. It has not addressed how GM could help with the very real risks faced by the hungry and malnourished. There are costs associated to excessive precaution. Doing nothing is doing something. Hunger and malnutrition are real risks, risks that kill over 20,000 people daily, and most of those who die are children. These are not talking points, they're people. As a mother and a scientist, what concerns me is the fear-mongering campaign against genetically modified food is forestalling scientists from using this breeding method to help produce more nutritious and sustainable food sources for millions of people. Vote yes for GM food.
Thank you, Allison Van Eenennaam. And our motion is genetically modify food, and here to give his closing statement against this motion, Chuck Benbrook. He is program leader of Measure to Manage Farm and Food Diagnostics for Sustainability and Health.
Unfortunately, the way that the GE technology and crop revolution has unfolded, it's really turned into kind of an arms race with weeds using herbicides as the sole hammer. And as a result, we've had this spread of resistant weeds and rapid, especially in the last 10 years, escalation in the use of herbicides. In 1995, the year before the GE revolution, there was about 27 million pounds of glyphosate applied by farmers in American agriculture. 10 years later, it had gone up to 157 million pounds. And in 2014, USDA data shows pretty clearly it's about 230 million pounds of glyphosate was applied. We have about 300 million acres of cultivated cropland. So we're talking about two-thirds of a pound of glyphosate herbicide, if it was spread evenly across the United States, could be applied on every acre of cropland. That's why we've got glyphosate in our blood, in our hair. That's why the scientists are concerned, even though it's generally regarded as a relatively safe pesticide, there's reason for serious worry here.
Thank you, Chuck Benbrook. The motion, genetically modify food, and here to summarize his position supporting this motion, Robert Fraley, Executive Vice President and Chief Technology Officer at Monsanto.
What I'd like to do is actually highlight what a vote against the motion really means, what it would be like to live in a world without GMO crops, what that would look like. First thing, there'd be a significant impact to the land. Without GMOs, farmers would need to dramatically increase their use of herbicides and insecticides. I estimate it'd be about 100 million pounds added to the environment each year. Second, since GMOs improve yields and help farmers deliver more food, in their absence means we're going to have to farm more land. And the pressure that will put on will mean we'll drain more wetlands, we'll cut down more forests, we'll look at more prairie lands because people will fundamentally eat. Third, voting against the GMO technology really means exacerbating climate change because it means we go backwards. We have to take tractors and run up and down the fields and plow, and we release more greenhouse gas emissions. Banning GMO crops is equivalent to taking and putting 26 million new cars on the road from a greenhouse perspective. And finally, voting against GMOs means foregoing all those opportunities that Dr. Van Eenennaam has talked about. You know, it's a relatively new technology. The future is ahead of us. We're at the tip of the iceberg. iceberg stage in what's possible. So I hope for the sake of all of our families, and I hope for the sake of all the people on the planet, that you vote to keep all of our options open and vote yes to support GM food.
Thank you, Robert Fraley. And the motion is genetically modify food. And here to summarize her position against the motion, Margaret Mellon, a science policy consultant and former senior scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists.
If you want to know what the world would look like without GE, you might want to look at Europe. Europe has an incredibly productive agriculture, so much so that they're all paying, you know, subsidies just like we're paying. I would say they're still using too much in the way of herbicides and pesticides, but it's a very productive, safe, capable agriculture system that, you know, we would all be, I think, very comfortable to live in. We have to look at the fact that there are still safety concerns about this technology, particularly about the long-term effects. And that's what the American Cancer Society says. Yes, the current products are safe, but the long-term concerns are still out there. So we can't pretend that those issues have been thrown away. I think we can say that since genetic engineering has been introduced, it has simply failed to address the big problems that are out there, but that there are technologies that can do that.
So, Margaret Mellon, I'm sorry, your time is up. Thank you very much.
I urge you to vote against it.
And that concludes round three of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. The first thing I want to say is this is obviously a very, very passionate debate, and there are strong feelings on all sides. But even with that, I felt that the integrity and the civility the debaters brought to the stage, they lived up to the spirit of Intelligence Squared. So I congratulate you all for that. All right, I now have the final results. You have voted twice, once before the debate and once again after the debate, and again the numbers. And again, the team whose numbers have changed the most in percentage point terms will be declared our winner. Let's look at the first vote. In the first vote on the motion, genetically modified food, 32% agreed, 30% were against, 38% were undecided. Those are the first results. Remember again, the team whose numbers change the most between first and second will be declared our winner. Let's look at the second vote. The team arguing for the motion, their second vote was 60%. They went from 32% to 60%. They picked up 28 percentage points. That is the number to beat. But let's look at the team against the motion. Their first vote was 30%. Second vote, only 31%, only a 1% move. That means the team arguing for the motion, genetically modified food, has carried this debate. Our congratulations to them. And thank you from me, John Donvan, and Intelligence Squared U.S.
Oh, dear, dear, dear me. I never know what to say at these UN cocktail parties. I never know what to say.
Well, I didn't expect to see you here, Pope Benedict.
Oh, my old friend, Dennis Lenin, President Hugo Chavez. How are you? Good to see you.
Well, I'm doing very well. You know, I'm a big fan of yours. But it seems we have both said a few things that have got us in hot water lately, no? Well,
tell me about it. It's very difficult to admit that you are wrong, especially when you're infallible. It's not easy being Pope. Having to spend each day with rosaries and such. When I think it would be cooler to be Buddhist or Amish or have something much more colorful where you don't spend all your time apologizing to altar boys or making the Muslim world upset.
Hey, it's not easy being me. Venezuela's got inflation through the roof. And so to keep my numbers up, I have to go to the UN and say things about George Bush like he's the devil, and I smell sulfur when that smell turned out to be John Bolton's cheap aftershave.
But Venezuela's got oil,
and popes wear really cool hats, and you've got throngs that adore you.
You've got something more too. You get to have sex. If Pope is all there is to be, with so much ire, I'm so tired. What if I get fired?
The next job we're headed for, we'll join the Dixie Chicks on tour.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.